From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Revenues from gambling now contribute more than $1 billion to Maryland's budget. Dozens of student journalists at the University of Maryland College Park just spent months following the money and writing about it. We talk with two of them and their professor. Then, ever wondered what it would be like to live in space? Astronaut and Cockeysville native Reid Weissman is calling the International Space Station home until November. He talks about it with Tom Hall from more than 200 miles above the Earth. Plus, does the meaning of the Star-Spangled Banner change depending on how you sing it? Tom visits a new exhibition at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, which showcases several interpretations of the national anthem and artists' commentary on connections to the American flag. News is next.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. People who play the Maryland Lottery or games of chance at Maryland casinos are paying a growing share of the state's budget. Not nearly as much as the sales tax or income taxes, but enough that a team of student journalists at the University of Maryland College Park spent most of the spring pursuing a basic tenet of journalism: follow the money. From whose pockets is gambling money coming? What is the state doing with its share? And how is it changing? Students in at least four classes at the Philip Merrill College of Journalism produced a multi-part series for Capital News Service called All In, Maryland's Big Bet. MarylandReporter.com has been running part of the series this week, and we want to hear some of what the young reporters turned up. Joining us from California, where she has an internship with the Santa Barbara News Press, is Layla Sarcevic, a graduate student in multi-platform journalism. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
From Washington, at his job at a graphics design firm, we're joined by journalism graduate Nicholas Duquesne. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sheila.
And from the College Park campus, Deborah Nelson, associate professor of investigative journalism. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Now, Professor Nelson, Deborah, how did this series come to be?
Well, every spring, the investigative reporting class collaborates with the Baltimore Urban Affairs class and Capital News Service and whoever else we can recruit in the Philip Merrill College of Journalism, on an in-depth examination of a problem or an issue that affects Marylanders. And this year's idea actually came from a family friend over Thanksgiving dinner who said, why don't you have your students look at the lottery? It's become an important source of revenue for the state. And my impression is that I bet if you look at the data, that a disproportionate amount is being paid by lower-income residents. So I thought this would be a classic government accountability project of the sort that's, you know, kind of becoming rare in newsrooms because as staffs dwindle. But it's something that with our combined resources we could tackle at University of Maryland. So I got the data, put in a public records request, got the data, and turned it over to Layla and Nico.
So, Layla Sarcevic, what was your assignment? How did it start?
So it started having a look at the state budget and having a look at the lottery agency's budgets too, and seeing, you know, well, hold on, how much money is being spent and where is that money going? And then if we look at the neighborhoods where it's coming from, and the public records request that Professor Nelson filed was very helpful in that we had a breakdown of every sales agent and how much revenue they were gaining, and that gave us, then we mapped that together with some census data, and that really gave us a picture of where the money was coming from which neighborhoods. And then we came to a question of, well, are these neighborhoods actually benefiting? And is the state benefiting? And if so, how?
And so what did you end up writing?
So we divided up the income groups using census data by zip codes, and they were ranked by household income, and then evenly divided by population into five income groups. And in those income groups, the lower the income group, the higher the lottery spending, which means that over 50% of the revenue came from zip codes in the bottom two groups, and they both earn below the state's median income. So that was a really interesting finding. And then we also found that most of the money, quite big chunks of money, came from some of the state's poorest neighborhoods, like Park Heights, which has a medium income of $35,000. And yet there, in 2012, people spent $34 million on lottery tickets. And so that was an interesting finding. And then we discovered that we had a look at where the money goes, and most of the money ends up in the general fund. And from there, it could pay for absolutely anything that the general fund pays for, which is a lot of different things in the state.
And your reporting was focused especially on the lottery.
Yes, that's correct.
Nicholas, and your reporting was focused more on casino money, correct?
Yeah, early on in the project, we divided up to focus on either casinos or lottery. So I was put on the casino side, and from there, we divvied up based on topic and based on location. So I primarily focused on both local impact grants, which were one source of, or one eventual destination for casino revenues to the state, and also focused on the Hollywood Casino in Perryville, which was the first to open in the state.
Tell us a bit about what local impact grants are.
So a certain portion of casino revenues, but specifically slots revenues, not from table games, are set aside. It's 5.5% of revenues are set aside to be local impact grants. And the thinking was that any negative externality that would come in to a community based on a casino being there could be offset by that specific local area that was home to a casino receiving a portion of the profits. So not only would it go to the state as a whole, but it would flow to the communities that actually hosted the casinos.
And you chose Perryville because the local impact grants had such a big impact there?
Yeah. Initially, I was focused on Perryville just because it was the first casino and it was one that needed to be looked at. But what immediately caught my eye was pouring through the town budgets, their biggest source of revenue anywhere beyond property taxes, beyond anything else, was these local impact grants. Over 30% of their yearly revenues and their yearly operating budget was funded by these casino grants. And while the amount they got wasn't the most of anywhere in the state, the percentage of which it made up their town budget was huge.
And describe for me what kind of impact you found.
So they were getting a little over $1.5 million a year. And so that money funded a variety of different projects. One, it funded planned renovations of both the town hall and the police station. The Perryville Police Force right now is operating out of a double-wide trailer, and so they were really hoping to expand their police station and be able to be working out of a real station. And so that was one of the main projects. They funded programs called local impact grants and downtown revitalization grants, where local business owners could apply for anywhere from $10,000 to $25,000 worth of grants, either to revamp their business or for a community project. They were able to lower property taxes in the town for the 3 years running that the casino was open. They hired police officers. They gave money to the Little League. Almost all areas of the town seemed to benefit.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Professor Deborah Nelson, who teaches investigative journalism at the University of Maryland College Park. She edited the series Capital News Service did about gambling in Maryland, All In, Maryland's Big Bet. Also with us are two of the reporters, Layla Sarcevic and Nicholas Duquesne. Nicholas, picking up the story, though, you said you found in your reporting that that picture of a great deal of support for Perryville is changing.
Yes. So one thing that we noticed in our reporting, and as we focused on the expansion that had already occurred in the state and the expansion that is still coming, was that every single time a new casino opens its doors in the state of Maryland, revenues at every other existing casino fall. And while overall the state is making more money each time a new casino opens its doors, the portion of money that flows to the local communities is dependent only on the revenues at their local casino. So when those local casinos' revenues fall, so does the local funding that flows to it. So when Maryland Live opened their doors, the Hollywood Casino in Perryville saw an immediate 30% drop in revenues. Their monthly revenues went down from anywhere from $9 million a year to closer to $7 million a year. And as a result, Perryville, who had been making plans and budgeting out 3 and 4 year plans, was all of a sudden seeing a shortfall of the cash that they had expected.
And you expect Maryland Live to see the same thing when the Baltimore Casino opens?
Yes. So Maryland Live has been the biggest success so far in the state since this opened its doors. But it's later this month. It's August 26th, I believe, is the planned opening for the Horseshoe Casino in downtown Baltimore. And just as Maryland Live cut into Perryville's revenues, the Baltimore Casino will cut into Maryland Live, and also Perryville's even further, will cut into their revenues as well.
Deborah Nelson, how many student journalists were involved in this whole project?
Oh, now you're going to make me count up. There were a lot. What do you think, guys, about 20?
20, 25 between all 20-ish. The classes?
Yeah. Nico was actually in two different classes that collaborated. The business class did research on the casinos. A video class did our multimedia work. An online class put together our website and did the data analysis. And the investigative reporting class looked at statewide issues and policies. And then we have the Baltimore class.
The Baltimore Urban Affairs reporting class. When you look at this kind of flood the zone coverage and you look at the state of journalism in the real world today, is it likely that these young journalists are going to have this experience often?
Absolutely. That's what we're aiming for. This sort of collaboration is the way investigative reporting is happening out there in the professional world now. Individual newsrooms are too small to tackle big projects like this. And so what you're seeing is more collaborations across organizations, nonprofits with mainstream organizations, radio stations like yours with student journalists. It's the way investigative reporting will survive in this interim period while we're trying to figure out how to refinance the industry.
We're almost out of time, so I'm going to ask Nicholas and Layla each quickly, what is, you think, the most important thing that you turned up in your reporting? Layla?
I think for me it was that we can't tell where this money goes. And to listen to state legislators say, oh, it'll go to education, it'll go to these things, well, we don't know that. And more importantly, I think also that people really in these communities that are paying most for it really are suffering. And there doesn't seem to be any solutions to help them through this and you know, bring their communities back from the brink.
Nicholas, what's the most important thing you think you turned up?
I think it's twofold. On the flip side from what Layla said, I saw the benefits that this money can have on local communities, but at the same time, it's a cautionary tale of expansion. And Perryville was lucky enough to plan for the fact that the money they received may dwindle, and hopefully other casinos in the state and other communities will follow suit.
I appreciate you all talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Deborah Nelson, who teaches investigative journalism at University of Maryland College Park, edited the series Capital News Service did about gambling in Maryland, All In, Maryland's Big Bet. Layla Sarcevic is starting her last semester at College Park as a graduate student in multi-platform journalism. Nicholas Duquesne graduated in May and is working for MAGA Design in Washington, D.C. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and a link to the Capital News Service where you can read the series, cnsmaryland.org/gambling. I'm Sheila Cass. This is Maryland Morning. Stick with us. We're going to space.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Since the end of May, Cockeysville native Reed Weissman has been living and working on the International Space Station, about 200 miles above the Earth. He'll be there for about 4 more months. We talked to him right before he launched into space in the spring, and on Wednesday, we caught up with Commander Weissman from the International Space Station. It's good to talk to you again, sir. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm always good when I'm talking to people from Maryland. It's great to be with you this morning.
Great to have you here. So now you're traveling at just under 5 miles per second, about 17,000 miles an hour. How long does it take you to orbit the planet?
So we lap the Earth once every 90 minutes. So that gives us about 16 sunrises and sunsets each day.
And how do you even keep track of daytime, nighttime? I mean, how do you work that out in terms of your sleep schedule and your work schedule?
Well, sure. When we're inside, if you're not looking out the window, you can definitely lose track of day and night. But we work based on Greenwich Mean Time, and we work a regular day. So I wake up around 6:30 in the morning, start the work day about 7:30, and then we wrap up around 7:30 at night and have a little bit of time for pre-sleep, and then I'm off to bed around 10 p.m.
So you have taken some really beautiful photographs and sent some beautiful video on your Twitter account, your Vine account, and you've got about 200,000 followers here on Earth. You've been looking at the Earth from this amazing perspective for the last couple of months. Has your view of life on Earth evolved and changed at all since you've been up there?
That's a great question, and no one's really asked me that yet. I would say it has in many ways. First of all, our planet is amazingly beautiful and way more complex and dynamic than I ever imagined. And the thing that I think really strikes me is the night passes. And if you are over land, almost entirely you see lights and you see humans, you see civilization down there. And really, it just brings home to me that our planet's actually pretty small when you come down to it. 90 minutes to lap our planet, and it really looks small from up here.
I wonder, and forgive me if this is too personal a question, but are you lonely?
No, that's definitely a great question. Not lonely at all. I'm flying up here with five of my best friends, three Russians, a German, and another American, and we really have a good time. We all get along. We like sports. We have similar tastes in what we want to do, and we have a great time.
You are a decorated fighter pilot. You've been deployed, I guess, five times. Is that right?
Oh, I think I lost count, and we should tack this one on as a deployment as well, so we'll call it six.
Yeah, and I just wonder, I mean, how does this deployment compare with your other military deployments in terms of, you know, missing your family, your wife, you have two kids, you know, that kind of stuff? How does it compare?
Well, it may not seem too logical, but my connectivity from up here, thanks to the good folks at NASA on the ground, is fantastic. So I actually get to talk to my wife and kids once a week, and that's really a great morale booster. And then our email has been really good. We have real-time email now as long as we have a good satellite link. So I get a couple of emails a day. My wife's been sending me pictures and little video clips of the kids. So I stay in touch, and it's really nice.
That's terrific. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Astronaut Reid Weissman joins me from the International Space Station. So, Commander, this is your first time in space. You've been up there for a little more than 2 months. Can you remember what you thought it would be like and how that's compared to what it's actually like?
Oh, sure. You know, before you launch, this has been a dream of mine essentially my whole life that I can remember. And so you build it up a lot in your head, a lot. And you don't expect that there's any way it could live up to your expectations. And then when the engines cut off on your rocket and you're floating for the first time, you realize, first, the Earth is way more beautiful than you ever expected when you look out the window. But second, that living and working up here, at least initially, is way harder than you ever dreamed. So just turning off gravity, my whole world was twisted upside down. And it took me at least a few weeks before I was comfortable up here.
What's the biggest part of the adjustment to being in a weightless environment?
Just waiting for your body to figure it out. Your brain needs time to understand that there isn't a floor, a ceiling, and two walls. It's just all surfaces. And then your digestive system, how do you eat, how do you go to the bathroom, and you just got to wrap your body around all that. And eventually it figures it out. It took me about 2 solid weeks, and then everything started to run like clockwork.
And what kind of work? What is the specific work that you're charged with yourself on the space station?
Basically, I'm a run-of-the-mill flight engineer. I'm standing in the U.S. lab. It's absolutely covered in science experiments. I'm standing right next to Robonaut, a great robot we have up here. So my main tasks are, first, keep my body in shape, so I'm working out about 2 hours a day. Second main task is keep this space station running clean and correct, so maintenance is a huge priority for us. And then third, and really our highest priority as an organization, is conducting the science up here. And we've been hot and heavy on science for the last 2 months.
You were scheduled to do a spacewalk in just a couple of weeks on the 21st of August. That's been postponed. Why has it been postponed? And do you have a sense of when it will be rescheduled?
Well, sadly, it has been postponed, and they figured out that there's an issue with our batteries in our spacesuits. And so I think it's awesome that Mission Control down in Houston decided to push these off. Of course, I'm a little sad about that, but when I go out the door, I want it to be in a good, clean configuration. And so we're hoping right now, maybe early to mid-October, we may be able to reschedule these. But in reality, when the suits are ready, we'll do the spacewalks. And if it's not our crew, then it'll be the next or maybe the crew after that. And in the meantime, the station's in a great configuration and everything's running smooth.
And you are actually training for that spacewalk as you're up in space on the ISS. You sent a tweet about a laptop simulator. How's that training going?
Well, unfortunately, now the training is pretty much stopped, so we kind of cleaned up what we were doing. But the training up here is really fascinating. We have a laptop that we can wear on our head, like you were mentioning, and it gives us a 3D view of the space station. It uses a little webcam, actually. Very simple technology, but very effective. So wherever I was looking, I was actually seeing an image outside the space station, and I was able to maneuver to the different work sites, look around, see what would be a danger, what would be easy, what would be hard. So for me, it was really fantastic training. And I was working with a gentleman, our commander, Steve Swanson, who's done many spacewalks. So to have a veteran like him at my side helping me out was just fantastic.
And when you eventually get outside the spacecraft for your spacewalk, what will you be doing specifically?
Well, the first thing we're going to do is change out a sequential shunting unit, which is part of our solar array system, which provides energy for everything that that we have inside. It's all based on solar power, of course. So that one of our components on one of our eight arrays failed a few months ago, and that's our primary task, is to fix that. And then after that, we're going to do some basic reconfiguration work, basically reassembling the furniture outside so that we can have crewed vehicles launching from U.S. soil in 2017 and come dock with the International Space Station.
Well, it really sounds terrific. And Commander Weissman, I really appreciate your time, and we look forward to catching up with you again during your incredible historic journey on the ISS. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, and I look forward to our next meeting.
Reed Weissman, he's a Cockeysville native and an astronaut who joined us from the International Space Station. We've got a link to Commander Weissman's Twitter feed on our website, WYPR.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Don't space out on us. Lots more ahead on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's WYPR.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Next month, Baltimore will be front and center as the nation celebrates the 200th anniversary of Francis Scott Key's poem that eventually became our national anthem. There'll be a nationally televised concert featuring the Baltimore Symphony and a gaggle of big stars, and many other events at Fort McHenry and around the state. Today, I'm at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture, where they're featuring an intriguing exhibition that explores the history of the American flag, with particular attention to the stories surrounding the flag that are not well known or often told. It's called For Whom It Stands, and it includes more than 100 works of art, artifacts, and documents that tell the story of our flag as an iconic symbol. I'm joined here at the Lewis Museum by its director, Dr. Skip Saunders, as well as the beatboxer Shotake, who has created some audio installations for the exhibition. So good morning to you both. Shotake, I want to start with you. There is a screen, a video screen here as part of the exhibition For Whom It Stands, and there are a number of different versions of the Star-Spangled Banner. You've been looking into this, the history of this song and the history of the way people have interpreted it for quite a while now, mm-hmm. for more than a year. What have you found?
I found that there's a standard default culture, if you will, regarding the national anthem and the flag. And what I wanted to do was veer away from that as much as possible and find as many culturally alternative versions of the Star-Spangled Banner, the song and its legacy, and have that offer another voice, therefore offer another story, and even more beyond that, hopefully untold stories regarding the song and its legacy.
So who are some of the artists and some of the people whose versions you've decided to include in this audio installation?
Well, I selected the number 15 as numerical tribute to the number of stars and stripes that were sewn into the flag by Mary Pickersgill for Fort McHenry during the War of 1812 and 1813. And some of the more vital or indispensable interpretations include Ethel Ennis and her performance at Nixon's re-inauguration in 1973. Of course, Jimi Hendrix, but also Michael Winslow's embodiment and interpretation of Jimi Hendrix playing the Star-Spangled Banner as he's doing it all with his voice, the sound effects master from Police Academy fame, Lorna Hermione Horace's singing the Star-Spangled Banner in the Lakota language, Renee Marie singing Lift Every Voice and Sing to the tune of the Star-Spangled Banner. So to me, these are some of the more vital and indispensable alternative versions of the anthem that offer, that shed light on a larger dynamic legacy and therefore a larger conversation, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a couple of them. When you're here at the Lewis Museum, all you got to do is press your finger on the artists. Here's from the 2008 State of the City Address in Denver, Colorado. And Renee Marie was asked to sing the Star-Spangled Banner. And it looks like she surprised everybody when instead of singing "O Say Can You See" by the Dawn's Early Light, she used the tune of the Star-Spangled Banner, but she sings the words to Lift Every Voice and Sing.
Every voice and sing, till earth and heaven ring.
You can see this is a videotape, and as you see her singing this, there's a bunch of surprised people looking on. Some have their hands over their hearts, and they say, "What is this woman doing?" Of course, Lift Every Voice and Sing, thought of as the African-American national anthem. But she uses the tune of the Star-Spangled Banner and uses the words from the great song, Lift Every Voice and Sing. As you mentioned, you've got some of the iconic versions that people are very familiar with, Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock, and then a reinterpretation of that. Mm-hmm. You've got Whitney Houston singing it at the Super Bowl with the Florida Symphony. Mm-hmm. You've got several versions by Marvin Gaye, and I want to press on Marvin Gaye's picture. There's a version that he sang in 1979, and then there's another version that he sang in 1983. At the NBA All-Star Game in California. And then there's a third version, incredibly intriguing. This is Nona Gaye, Marvin Gaye's daughter, singing in 2004 at the NBA All-Star Game in L.A., and she sings it as a duet with her father, who is on videotape in the background. How did you come across this, and what do you think the significance of this is?
Oh, I came across this in my research of how Marvin Gaye has done it throughout his career. And to me, this is powerful because it speaks more to the legacy of the Gaye family. It's more about their legacy than it is about the Star-Spangled Banner, so therefore the anthem has become so much more personalized as it's filtered through the Marvin Gaye legacy and it's continuing on with his daughter. And so I think a lot of these versions are about individuals, musicians and non-musicians, having a more personal relationship with the Star-Spangled Banner by veering away from it a little bit and having their own takes on it, or veering away from it in an extreme manner, you know, but both have very powerful effects.
Here's Marvin Gaye and his daughter Nona.
Stripes and
it's really beautiful, and there they are, father and daughter singing together. And of course, you can just, you know, literally at the touch of a screen, you can get these very different versions. There's a terrific version of Stevie Wonder doing it at an NBA game, and you'd expect maybe some soulful, beautiful, you know, pop ballad arrangement by Stevie Wonder, but not quite, huh? What do we have here from Stevie?
Stevie taking on the Star-Spangled Banner with a chamber ensemble situated behind him, led by a conductor, and Stevie Wonder at the lead, at the helm, holding the reins with the harmonica, not his voice. And it's kind of bluesy, it's kind of melancholy, but again, personalized in a completely different way, as if to say, you know, I can't sing these words, I can't sing these lyrics, but I can still adhere to the melodic structure of the song because there's something else to say here. Perhaps it's a moment of reconciliation and rebellion at the same time, just like with what Renee Marie did. So it's interesting to interpret, but my guess would be there's an expression of reconciliation and rebellion all at once.
So Stevie deciding to go just with the harmonica instead of with his voice.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning. I'm here at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. Dr. Skip Saunders joins us as well. And Skip, this exhibition is broken down into four or five component parts, including a little fragment of the original flag that Mary Pickersville put together in this very block that the Lewis Museum sits on.
Yes.
But there's a story of a young African American girl named Grace Wisher, which also figures quite prominently in the story of the original flag.
Yes, it does. And one of the beautiful things, Tom, is the collaboration that we had with the Flag House. We really partnered in this exhibition, and they actually took some of the open call art that we have, and they're displaying that. But this particular fragment comes from them on loan to us, and it helps remind us that although Mary Pickersgill certainly, you know, sewed the flag, she had with her this young teenage servant girl, Grace Wisher, whom hardly anyone knows, who was also very much a part of the sewing of this flag. So, again, to me, it speaks of the inclusion that is America all the time. And then, as you'll see across the other side of the special exhibit gallery, we've got another photograph of a government worker during the World War II era who's doing the very same thing that Grace Wisher did so many years before her, sewing and making a flag for the government.
But we don't know her name. We don't know the circumstances. And so very, very similar to Grace Wisher, who was really an unknown
being. Yes,
mm-hmm.
You know, and thankfully we've been able to discover her story and show that America has been America from the beginning if we just want to accept that and live that way.
There are many pieces by contemporary artists from around the country. There are some iconic pieces as well. One is the great photograph by Gordon Parks, the terrific African-American photographer. This dates from the early 1940s, called American Gothic, where there is a woman who is like that Grant Wood's painting, American Gothic, holding a broom and a mop behind her is an American flag. This is a powerful photograph, isn't it?
So powerful, and it really asks the question, what does the flag mean to her, especially when you look at the three companion photographs that accompany this, where she's coming home and two of them at 2 a.m. in the morning. You see it's a very low-standard apartment. She's raising three children in what looks like a very cramped space. And the fourth photograph where she's back at work with the government flag behind her, this time holding her cleaning instrument, and you learn that she's making $1,080 a year. What does that mean to her? What's the meaning there? And part of what I think only the Reginald F. Lewis Museum could do is to make this presentation in the midst of our celebration where we all love our country and our flag means so much to us, but that doesn't mean we're perfect yet. That doesn't mean we don't have a long way to go. And so this is that kind of voice that stands slightly askance and says, yes, we are wonderful, but we can be even more.
Of course, the flag, a subject of controversy, not just the way people sing the national anthem, but the flag itself, used in art, used in public protests. There's a photograph here of the flag actually being used literally as a weapon at a protest in Boston, someone trying to spear somebody with the end of a flag. You've got a section here of the exhibition called Courting Controversy, and there's a really interesting couple of pieces by Faith Ringhold called The People's Flag Show. Faith Ringhold put on an exhibition involving the flags and was quite summarily arrested.
She was arrested for the disrespect she was showing the flag, and so she got out and she did something in even bolder and brighter colors, celebrating her companions and herself, the Judson Three. And I'm so glad that the curator, Dr. Michelle Wilkinson, thought to include this because sometimes we need to be reminded that patriotism can also be dissent, and when we're talking about really protecting our freedom of speech and our right to be individuals. And as you see, that also is expressed in the straitjacket that was done by this artist after the passage of the Patriotic Act, and this is called an unpatriotic act, and it's sort of like straitjacketing us so that we can't express, even in the midst of such a great calamity and crisis.
Yeah, this is the law passed during the Bush administration following 9/11, the
yes.
Patriot Act. You know, even the name of that, quite controversial.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I guess thank God for our artists because they keep calling us to accounts, right, to look beyond the facade and see what's really lying underneath. Are we killing our freedom by going too far sometimes?
Well, this is a really intriguing and fascinating exhibition. It's terrific. I know it's been given kudos from everybody from USA Today to Baltimore Magazine and lots of other folks, and it's really terrific and well worth folks' time coming down and check it out. So, Skip Saunders, thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much. And I also just wanted to point out one other thing, how inclusive it is. We've got Asian American artists, Jewish American artists, Muslim American artists. So it's really trying to tell us who are Americans and what does America mean. It means so much.
Dr. Skip Saunders, he's the director of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. For Whom It Stands, The Flag and the American People is here at the Lewis Museum until February. There's a companion exhibition as well. It's called For Whom It Stands 2, and it's right down the block at the Star Spangled Banner Flag House. That's there until September 14th. That's the 200th anniversary of the date on which Francis Scott Key penned the poem that became our national anthem. We've got more information about both exhibitions on our website. Come to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. On 88.1 WIPR, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass reporting from the Lewis Museum near Baltimore's Inner Harbor. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us.
Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. The program is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. Tom Hall is our culture editor. Coffee provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville on the web at zekescoffee.com. You can find us online at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. You can leave a comment about something you heard or make a suggestion about an interview you think you should hear on our show. On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. The whole Maryland Morning team is glad you're listening. Have a great weekend.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.